So until I was 28 years old, I was normal. That's what passes for humor among psychologists. And also, anybody who actually knows me, that would get a belly laugh. But the day that my self-delusional normality unraveled was at a hike in the backcountry of Yosemite. When we came up upon the 10,000-foot elevation of Clouds Rest, I don't know if anybody's ever been up there, I walked out on a 100-yard knife edge, looked down, it's a rock scramble, looked down 4,000 feet on one side, 2,000 feet on the other side, and although, you know, when I was at that time a physicist and an engineer, I don't really understand vanishing points that much, but as I looked out that 100 yards and it came to a point, I said to myself, you can't balance on that point. And it's 4,000 feet on one side and 2,000 on the other. And I got down on my hands and knees and crawled backwards off of that knife edge. It seemed the only logical and rational thing to do. Well, the only thing worse than living on a knife edge is falling off of one side or the other. The anthropic principle in cosmology, I probably will rename this anthropic coincidence, in cosmology is that physical existence as we know it and life as we know it exists only because there are physical constants and that have values within a narrow band, a knife edge, so to speak. Those constants describe the fundamental forces of nature: gravitation, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear force, and the Higgs force, which I didn't have in there, but I now have in there. He learns. Thus, we can summarize this by saying in a simplified shorthand that physical reality is perfectly fit for human life. It's not that life evolved within existing conditions to adapt to or fit these constants, but rather the anthropic principle argues that before there was evolution, there were these fundamental constants that made it just right for our existence, and for evolution, in fact, to take place. Those constants that had different values outside of some narrow band, then existence, much less human life, would be impossible. So to reduce this anthropic coincidence to its essence, some physical properties are constant and existence can exist only in the margins between the two boundaries, on a knife edge. So now that I'm a psychologist, I wanted to tackle it a little different idea using the metaphor of the physical anthropic principle. The question, is there such a thing as psychological fine-tuning? Are there fundamental characteristics of human psychological experience that represent a tension within the bounds of which psychological integrity exists, but outside of which psychological integrity can't exist or doesn't exist? Certainly, knowledge of psychological scientific principles is less precise and less mathematically described than in the physics realm. But there are suggestions that despite our inability to quantify such psychological fine-tuning, psychological fine-tuning might exist. And in these brief moments, I hope to sketch these suggestions in broad and imprecise strokes. Then I'll suggest a kind of a tentative psychological anthropic principle, and I will use four headings to organize the way that I'm thinking. One is psychology, very briefly touch on theology, relationships, and society. So first, psychology. And I'll look first at cognition. Human cognition is broadly described as being system one and system two cognition. Only psychologists can come up with sophisticated names like this. Do not try this at home. Daniel Kahneman has summarized the working of these two cognitive systems brilliantly in a book recently called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. System one, thinking, occurs outside of conscious awareness, and yet it accounts for most of our cognition. It's fast, it's automatic, intuitive, operates according to efficient meaning-making system that has been fine-tuned by evolution to make fast decisions possible so that most of the time one can predict and control what might happen. System one cognition might include things like Freud's unconscious motivations, dynamics, and defenses, but it's not limited to Freud's observations. It can include cognitive heuristics, simplify decisions, judgments, and understanding, but do so at the cost of inaccuracies. System one cognition also includes expertise, honed into automatic ways of making decisions that require probably at least 10,000 hours of concentrated practice. System two cognition, what you're doing right now, is slow, it is deliberate, it is rational, it is logical, it's judgmental, and it can impose some degree of its will on our understandings that come from system one cognition. I say some degree of understanding because system two cognition depends on having inputs to reason about, and often those inputs from system one are come from system one, and thus, under the garbage in, garbage out principle, reasoning might not produce rationality or rationally driven products of thought if the products start with irrational system one cognition. For our purposes though, let's just say that all of life is really a constant struggle in our mind to maintain the proper tension between system one and system two types of cognition. In the physical anthropic principle, the constants presumably do not change, though masses, charges, even fundamental nuclear arrangements might vary. Similarly, while the conditions in which system one and system two cognition are constantly changing and thoughts are whizzing helter-skelter through our consciousness, presumably the boundaries between system one and system two and the way that system one and system two work are not changing, but exists within a narrow band. Morality. We find similar tensions in the moral realm. Humans seem to make moral motions. That is, we treat things as moral or not. While different subgroups of people might disagree radically about what is or isn't moral, there's always a sense that something is moral, something is right, and some things are not right. Most psychologists take a position that there are some acts that are good or virtuous. Their criteria for what makes up good or virtuous different, but people make this distinction. They're human strengths, and in positive psychology, virtue has made a resurgence lately. This has been mirrored in writings in theology, philosophy, and political science. Humans have a sense of right and wrong within certain subcultural and personal boundaries. But this is not the whole story. People seem to find it impossible to do what they believe to be right or virtuous consistently. And unless one has an antisocial personality disorder and has little conscience, one is usually bothered by personal moral failures and suffers at least some self-condemnation. self-control. We seem continually at war with self-indulgence. Yet, over-control of oneself seems to show up as psychopathology, with diagnoses like obsessive-compulsive personality disorders, obsessive-compulsive anxiety disorders, and other anxiety disorders that arise from lack of perceived control. In recent years, a social psychologist named Roy Baumeister has suggested that self-control is like a moral muscle. Like a muscle, it can be fatigued if it's overworked. I certainly didn't overwork it with the chocolate-covered donuts this morning, I must say. Thus, in any one of eight interchangeable self-control tasks in Roy Baumeister's lab, from tolerating ice water to resisting hot aromatic chocolate chip cookies to squeezing a grip dynamometer, a performance on any task results in less ability to perform well on a second task. Our self-control gets tired. Thus, optimum self-control is again living within this thin membrane of managing one's tasks so as not to deplete oneself control or ego strength. Now, like a muscle also, in Roy Baumeister's scheme, self-control can also be strengthened by successful efforts to control oneself. People ask simply to attend to your posture all week. Everybody will suddenly sit up well. You know, if you attend to your posture all week, you're able to perform better on self-control tasks when you come in a week later than people who are giving some other kind of attention focus that doesn't involve self-control. But the point remains, we need to live within a narrow range of temptations to self-indulgence, and we also need to succeed most of the time. Love. People who struggle with relationships, or people also struggle with relationships. There is an optimal balance that we all are juggling all of the time between intimacy, coaction, and distancing. There's an optimal balance between those three. That balance must be sustained over the course of our entire life. We balance those needs through the ways that we structure our time. So we make big decisions, like our choice of career, or our choice of mate, or leisure activities, which commit large blocks of time in predictable ways to either doing things alone, distancing, or doing things with others, but non-intimately, or doing things intimately with others. For example, if we have a high need for intimacy, we tend to choose career like a counselor or a pastor that puts us into intimate communication with people much of our day. If we have a high need for coaction, we might go into sales, where we interact a lot, but mostly in coactive ways. If we have a high need for distancing or alone time, we might choose careers like a writer, where we spend a lot of time alone. Our choice of mate follows the same principle. It balances among the coaction, the distance, and the intimacy. Some mates demand a lot of intimacy. Others a lot of coaction, and other mates want a lot of time spent alone. Justice and mercy. Mike McCullough argues that primates evolved with, among other needs, two group living motivated needs. First, primates need justice. That is, primates need to patrol the borders of their troop to prevent loss of resources to outgroups. They need to prevent fair use of the resources by members in the group. But if they deal with violations of justice by punishing the wrongdoing in a way that injures the animal or excludes the animal, then the troop won't last long, because either they will hurt their own, or they will drive them into a place where predation is likely. Thus, a second need also arose, and that is a need to reconcile. Forgiveness, a change in internal behavior, an internal intent about how I want to act toward a person, and also a change in motivation and emotion, seems more human and arose in social evolution rather than in animal evolution. But reconciliation is always in balance against justice. So we have those two social forces. Individualistic versus collectivistic self-construal. Societies tend to develop cultural norms that favor individuals or groups. As people live within those norms, they begin to construe their own identities in ways that are consistent with the cultural societal norms. The way that they see themselves is an internalized identification of the group norms in which they live. However, there are always tensions. So we are both individuals, but we are also affiliated with groups. So even in an intensely individualistic society like the United States, we still have lots of collectivistic emotions. And even in the most collectivistic cultures, there are always individualistic motivations. Mindfulness versus the division of our attention. Psychologist Jerome Singer argued that life is a battle for our limited attention, which flits back and forth between our internal experience and external stimuli. So if I ask you to daydream right now, something predictable would happen. You would probably duck your head and look at some very non-stimulating stimulus, like the floor. You would shut your eyes. You would block out the external so that you could attune to the internal. We're always dividing that attention between the internal and the external, and this ends up actually causing problems, such as when we're very preoccupied with those self-control problems I mentioned earlier. We don't attend to the little things like red lights, and we tend to have accidents. Okay, theology. Now, I'm not a theologian, so I'm going to just touch on this very briefly. But religious systems articulate theologies and philosophies. Those systems of belief, value, and practice help us live within the margins. But life poses a number of unresolved dilemmas, and each religious system tries to deal with those. So each system has to deal with basic theological questions. Just some examples, of course, are free will versus determinism. Whether we see the divine as sovereign, or whether we feel that we have personal control over some things. We must try to resolve ideas of whether life is a unity, or life is all diversity, or is life some kind of unity in diversity. Religious systems pose answers to those questions, and we live within those religious systems and adopt many of those answers. Relationships. Individuals are responsible agents and also are acted upon by outside forces. They interact with other individuals. As we are clearly aware, when people get together in relationships, they act differently than they do alone or in other relationships. I don't act the same with my graduate students as I do with my wife. I don't act the same with my soccer team where I'm spiking the ball down, you know, as when I'm giving a lecture in class and I take my computer and spike it down. I don't do that. People have vicious, hate-filled marriages, but they can be sweet and agreeable with everybody else in their life. Or they can be grumpy, cranky, and irascible in all of their relationships except for their spouse and close friend. How many despots in society have killed millions of people and yet had close personal relationships? Roy Baumeister mentioned him with the ego strength, and a number of colleagues reviewed several literatures from an evolutionary perspective. They supported an assumption informed by evolutionary psychology that the bad is stronger than the good. The bad is stronger than the good. Their reasoning follows this path. If one does not attend to good events in life, one misses out on valuable resources. But if one does not attend to danger and negatively tinged events, one may not survive the afternoon. Thus, Baumeister and colleagues argued that humans are hardwired for attending to the negative, and it is thus stronger than attending to the good. But clearly, life is not just negative. So good has an answer, and that is that the good defeats the bad by outnumbering the bad. We are not doomed to an evil world. Good strikes back and makes up for the numbers in numbers what it cannot match in power. Thus, people tend to walk a social knife edge, just like a psychological knife edge. The ratio of positive to negative events is remarkably constant for a life that is a stable life. In that 2001 paper, Baumeister et al. Adduced evidence for this phenomenon by looking at six totally different literatures and finding a need for a consistent 5-to-1 approximately relationship between good and bad events. They looked at research on everyday events in life. On major life events, trauma, close relationship outcomes, social network patterns, interpersonal interactions, and learning processes. Since the review in 2001 of Baumeister et al., three other areas have demonstrated this positivity-negativity asymmetry also. In couples, long-term couple relationships have been described by psychologist John Gottman. John Gottman described the modestly named Gottman ratio of the number of positive to negative interactions that couples have with each other as a crucial metric. In fact, he said, give me 10 minutes of behavior and I will tell you with 94% certainty, not 93, not 95, but 94% certainty, he says we're not mathematical, that, you know, whether a relationship will be together and happy 4 years from today. And the ratio, the metric that he uses is 5-to-1 ratio or higher, 94% chance you're going to be together and happy. Less than that on the ratio, you will not be together or happy. Language learning in children. How do kids learn words? Well, it turns out that it depends on the interactions that they have with their parents or crucial caregivers. 6-to-1 ratio of positive to negative events that happen in discipline and kind of teaching will predict a large number of words added to the vocabulary, less than 6-to-1. Step function down, much less of vocabulary learning. Positive emotion. The field of positive psychology has arisen starting in 1999 And within that field, one of the better known people is Barbara Fredrickson. She has described a third area since the Baumeister review, and she calls this the Losanda ratio, named after a colleague, see, much more modest. And she finds that a ratio of positive emotional experiences to negative of 3.6 or better will predict many, many outcomes: group productivity, individual productivity, mental health outcomes, all kinds of outcomes. So what we see here is that in relationships, again, we're looking at a knife edge. We're looking at something that there's a discontinuous fall off if you do not have the right ratio. There are also conditions where you might need a very much larger ratio, such as repairing damage to a relationship. Societal tensions. Star Trek is fond of posing, does the good of the one outweigh the good of the many? Jim, I think it does. So this is a societal question, of course. Does the good of the one outweigh the good of the many? What is the relationship in society between justice and mercy? You know, can't we are hardwired for justice. We are hardwired for mercy, but societally, what is our balance? What does that balance reveal about society? Can a society exist that just emphasizes justice? Can a society exist that just emphasizes mercy? I think there has to be a social balance in society. Exclusion versus embrace of outsiders. How do we treat people who are not in our in-groups? You know, we've been doing research, just for example, on what happens when people are in a church and someone in the church offends them. Is that worse or better than somebody who isn't in the church offending them? Well, it turns out it's way different, right? It's going to be, if someone in my church hurts me, the same way that an outsider hurts me, I think it's much worse that they hurt me, and I feel more unforgiveness and more injustice was done. Nevertheless, I'm still more inclined to forgive them than I am to forgive an outsider who's hurt me in what I perceive a less bad way. Freedom and equality is always a balancing point. You know, if we insist on equality in our society, we have to limit freedoms because we don't have an inherently just world. You know, if we insist on freedom, then things will change and equality will not exist. So in summary, I've given you a whole bunch of examples, I think, from psychology that show us that there's a constant struggle that we all face in how do we live within, between the margins, within the individual, within the relationship, within societies or groups. The edges push and pull on us. They create tensions, a word I've used several times. Why is this? What makes us feel tense as we move to the boundaries? Well, I think that we have a strong need for psychological consistency. We want to be consistent. This creates the range that is akin to this range in the physics anthropic consistencies, where life is restricted and I need to live within this range of what I feel to be consistent. And when that doesn't happen, then lots of things feel bad to me and create problems. So my consistency is a position of what is called critical realism. I believe that there is a reality, as Stephen mentioned, we can't necessarily know that reality. So as most physicists and most scientists believe, we operate as if there is a reality. And we try to make our best guesses and write our best equations in order to approximate that reality. But I can never epistemologically know with certainty that this reality, what this reality is. So I have to remain humble about what my knowledge base is. This need for consistency makes a lot of sense. The need for consistency makes evolutionary sense. We're more likely to survive if we can discern consistent rules, and we are not likely to survive if we ignore those rules. The need for consistency makes philosophic sense. We need some kind of philosophic system to impose a consistency on formal explanations about what is the meaning of life. This need for consistency makes theological sense. Theological systems seek to present views of the structure and function of reality that includes temporal and transcendent reality. Their starting point or central points tend to be transcendent and not corporeal, but consistency is all important to theology, just like it is to philosophy. So we may succeed more or less at creating a consistent way of looking at life, but we succeed more or less. And we also defend ourselves when we experience inconsistencies. Theories in psychology have existed for a long time about what happens when people experience some sense of dissonance. So we have cognitive dissonance theory with Leon Festinger. But also we have now research with Daniel Kahneman on System 1 and System 2 cognition and how we deal with the inconsistencies that happen that come usually out of the System 1 type of thinking. When we experience these inconsistencies, we defend ourselves, we do something, we change our cognition, our alarm bells of emotion start to go off. Freud says that we engage in these dynamic unconscious defenses in which we twist the kind of the meaning of things to fit with our reality, that our subjective reality. So we continually engage in behavioral and cognitive and unconscious manipulation to experience relief from the tension and anxiety and to achieve a measure of tranquility, though sometimes that tranquility is bought with a terrible psychological cost by changing our perception, our memory, our thought, our motivations. The need for perceived consistency, psychological anthropic principle, if you will, is so built into the human race that the consequences of inconsistency can be dire. When we have gross inconsistencies between our System 1 unconscious thinking, our System 2 conscious thinking, then we can have disturbances in our way of dealing with all of life. Basically, there's a malfunction. There's some kind of loss of integrity. There's some kind of implosion into ourself or explosion personally. This disintegration is parallel to considering worlds in which the fine-tuned physical constants might implode into each other or explode if the constants are not exactly in balance. And like worlds flying apart or collapsing within, exploding or imploding, psychological functioning similarly explodes or implodes. So in table one, which you have in your notes, I summarize the experience of disintegration that occurs with the loss of a sufficient sense of consistency. In each of four areas, religion, philosophy, science, and the personal, I speculate on the experience, the way that people malfunction in each different area, and the end that people come to in each area. For example, in the religious area, the experience of having an inconsistent religious worldview is one that is not providing, or one that is not providing answers, results in a feeling of lostness. One struggles with God or religious ideas and feels that one has lost or perhaps never developed a sense of religious rootedness. Julie Exelein and her colleagues have described many of the effects of these religious struggles, and theologian Laron Schultz and psychologist Steve Sandage team up to talk about periods of stable and relatively peaceful religious dwelling in our lives, but also times of religious seeking. So their idea is that all through life, we are continually bouncing back and forth between a sense of dwelling where I think is stable religiously, and then having something raise issues. And that sets me on some kind of quest to try to get back in some way to a stable outcome. It's not necessarily going to be the same stable outcome I started from. This is based on the theorizing of Robert Wuthnow at Princeton University. Consequences are similar for failures in philosophical systems. One feels a sense of existential crisis, loses a sense of meaning in life, and engages in existential wandering and the loss of identity. The existential philosophers like Sartre, Camus, Jaspers, and Heidegger have written extensively about the rootlessness of having no sense of meaning and the utter necessity to create, or in Christian existentialists like Kierkegaard, Tillich, to find a sense of meaning. They also have written about the heroic struggle to enact meaning and the ability of a sense of meaning to help people deal with horrendous suffering. When scientists experience such profound inconsistency, the result is a sense of crisis that Thomas Kuhn observed and described. Scientists experience the essential tension, which is what Kuhn called a position in which a new conceptual framework can solve a particular crisis in the old conceptual or theoretical framework, and yet there's no experimental evidence to support this new conceptualization, while the old conceptualization had plenty of evidence to support it. Lakatosh described the tenacity with which scientists hold on to a core research program when fundamental experiments fail. They attempt to hold on to consistency by revising the theory to retain the sense of consistency, modifying the peripheral or less central tenets of the theory. So again, we're fighting this battle of how do I stay consistent? If things don't stay consistent, my world goes up in the air. In the personal realm, inconsistencies in personal life are met with distress. When the inconsistencies and distress are experienced in an important area, psychological distress, disorders, and disturbances occur. With them, psychiatric diagnoses. Each, as we will see below, is biological, psychological, social, and spiritual, but is in a sense a manifestation of disintegration. Thus, in summary, the psychological anthropic principle might be a need for psychological consistency. And the fine-tuning constant for psychological function of the human psyche is the drive to be consistent in meaning, in mind, mind and body, individual and social realms, and the interrelationships among all of those. Failures in consistencies push and pull our minds, bodies, and relationships toward alienation, disconnection, and disintegration. They push people toward psychological disorders. So in Table 2, I described 6 major categories of psychological disorders. Without at all dealing with a very sophisticated ideological identification of them, and even out without considering the validity of looking at these very, very broad divisions that are so large, instead of looking at individual diagnostic categories, I just, by way of a conceptual point, observe the ways that different types of disorders can be interpreted to represent a disordering or disintegrating of consciousness as it exists in most people. Typically, people who are experiencing such disorders experience a separation and disconnection from their usual state of being. If we for a moment exclude people with chronic severe mental disorders for whom the disordered state is experienced as stressful and distressful, but not unusual because it is chronic, then we see that almost all people who are experiencing psychological disorders feel that inconsistency exists within their normal sense of being. I don't feel normal. We can tolerate a certain amount of inconsistency. We do it every day. But when we leave the boundaries of our normal experiences, then we experience distress and motivation to solve the problems, cope with the stresses, ameliorate the distresses. We're having our own personal Kuhnian mini scientific revolution. And like science, those revolutions have only a limited number of ways that they can end. We can resolve our personal crises and cope with the inconsistencies by eliminating the inconsistencies, but keeping the old system. We can block them psychologically, hoping that in the future, we might be able to deal with them, but also hoping that maybe we'll just forget them and they'll go away. Or we can experience a psychological revolution that either kicks us into a new mode of being that spells creativity or pushes us into a new mode of being that spells psychological distress and perhaps disorder. If people need to live within the limits for psychological harmony, it's a fair question to ask, can we do that? Theologians and philosophers suggest that basic questions answered more or less adequately by theological and philosophical systems are questions of ontology, morality, and epistemology. If we take the simple observation that one perfect system would be likely, by virtue of some survival of the fittest mechanism in society, I'm sure that that was a very exciting thought when I had it, but it did not translate on here. Basically, there's, obviously not one system that has somehow evolved so that it is the dominant system. So now there are many systems that we have to choose from. Christian pastor and speaker Larry Christensen once said that truth is like a hula hoop and human understanding is like a matchbox. One cannot put a hula hoop into a matchbox. Thus, truth comes at us in what seems to be paradoxes, as if the hula hoop is split and put into both sides of the matchbox. So if we look left, we see one side of a truth. Let's call it free will. If we look right, we see the other side. It's determinism. If we look left, we see the societal value of equality. If we look right, we see freedom. If we look left, we see psychological disorder. If we look right, we see creativity. By looking to one truth, we turn our attention from the other truth. It would be nice to think that this could lead us to living balanced and consistent lives between the edges, between the sides of truth, comfortably within the margins, or walking the knife edge along the ridge that gives a beautiful vista of a valley while posing danger of falling off of both sides of the ridge. Yes, that would be nice. But in a way, it lives. But in the way it lives out in our lives, we seem to run off the path on one side or the other. And then we look back at the other side of the truth and we try to get back onto the path again. This can lead to repeatedly running off the path on our favorite side or weaving back and forth from ditch to ditch. In fact, humans are more likely as individuals, I believe, to fixate on a single side, but as society, we tend to be more like a pendulum and weave back and forth across between the opposites. I'm not a pessimist, seeing us consigned to plunge off of the psychological, religious, philosophical, scientific, social, or societal cliffs of our life into the pit of despair. Don't even think about trying to escape, as the albino from The Princess Bride memorably said. So, rather, I am a critical realist, as I mentioned earlier. I'm epistemologically pessimistic about the certainty of our knowledge, and I use the word intentionally. I'm certainly pessimistic about reason as the primary method of guiding us there. But like the romantics of ages past, I believe that there are other things in life that do provide, in conjunction with reason, an adequate base for staying, if not on the path, at least on the mountain. For me personally, that's my faith, as rooted in historical biblical Christianity. My sense of connection with people, with nature, and with the transcendent, which I see it as manifestations of God. I acknowledge that other people may have a sense of the true that comes from different faiths or philosophic traditions, and there are legitimate grounds for disagreement among the systems. Nevertheless, it seems to be not just empirically seeing the world as it is and then inferring physical reality that is not observable that grounds us, but also it's the non-rational, the intuitive, the mysterious, and our personal experiences with God that are needed to keep us moving purposefully and with integration along the cliff, to give us confidence to walk down that knife edge that does not neatly, not really converge into a vanishing point that keeps opening up at our feet in front of us, and yet to give us a perspective of the beautiful valley that stretches out all around us. Thank you.
I like the metaphor of the knife edge very much. And it seems to me your four categories in table one, an important point would be that they are not entirely self-contained. That is, they interact. And in our personal growth, the notion of personal growth that we have, one of the problems of dissonance is, that the challenge of consistency is to grow in all four of these areas in a consistent way simultaneously. If one gets immersed in science in such a way that totally new insights come, one has to catch up in the religious category, as it were, in a way that they remain in balance, otherwise you're off the knife edge, or vice versa. personal crises can challenge religious notions to such an extent that one ends up as an atheist or whatever. So that the whole notion of growth, personal growth, means balancing all four of these dimensions together as well.
So what we have is a multiverse with four regions that have different constants in the regions. And the problem with that is that if the regions get next to each other, how do you make the transition between the regions? And so Maynard is pointing out exactly that inconsistencies can happen. What would happen to a particle that went from one region to another region? Yes, I think the inconsistencies are within each of those areas, but they're also at the border areas, and those do bring up problems that might set a person to wandering, out of their comfortable dwelling place into a seeking, wandering mode where they're trying to resolve their issues. What Steve Sandage finds as he and Laurent Schultz look at that wandering and seeking, or seeking and dwelling way of looking at things, is that actually most people resolve their crises within their basic system of belief. You know, when people get challenged in their faith, for example, some of them do absolutely just reject their faith. There are religious conversions where a committed secular person converts to religion, and there are loss of faith instances. That does happen, but more often what happens is the person goes away and is unsettled and is asking a bunch of questions trying to get settled, and then they come back with this fundamental same belief system, but also modified, and maybe even modified very fundamentally, that they look at their own assumptions differently.
I am struck by how Buddhist this sounds. Profoundly connects with the idea of the middle path, moderation in all things, about negotiating the extremes between extreme self-denial, extreme self-indulgence. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
I guess I'm going to try to answer quickly so that more people can ask. But I guess that I'm a big fan of the book that C.S. Lewis wrote in the 1940s called The Abolition of Man. And he talked about the Tao as being a kind of a common core that we would logically think exists. If there's one God that creates things, then different religious systems ought to have some things in common. And I think that is in common. I think it is a part of Buddhism, but it's also part of Hinduism, and there are strains in Christian theology and Judaism that do the same thing.
If I may, when I look at these areas of experience and malfunction, I would like another diagram that says, 8 hours of sleep, three meals a day, a certain amount of exercise, certain amount of interaction with other people. I think the way we schedule our lives has a lot to do with how we experience religion and our personal things and our relationship with others. I think when people go without sleep or go without meals or put too much emphasis one place or the other, all of these things start to fall apart. Your comment, please.
So I agree and admit that psychology has continued to be unbalanced. We have focused on pathology and what makes people sick because, you know, we want to make people happier. This positive psychology movement that started about 1999, I think, is the corrective on that. I teach a course in positive psychology, and it looks at, you know, what helps us to flourish. You know, the opposite of, you know, illness is, the absence of illness is not health, what makes us healthy.
One final question, please. We eat at 12:10. We're back here at 1 o'clock.
I was curious with the reference where you talk about positivity and negativity and ratios. Is this purely quantitative, or doesn't the determination of this being a positive or negative to some extent exist within the individual and possibly reflect their own needs for cognitive consistency? I also wondered if the size doesn't make a difference. If the size of the positives or the size of the negatives makes a difference. And finally, with these ratios such as 5-1, what if it was 10-1? So with your spouse, you had a 5-1 relationship, which should suggest a stable relationship. But with another member of the opposite sex, you had actually a 10-1 relationship. Would that mean that you would have an affair with them because it was a better ratio?
How long do y'all have? I think the important thing about those ratios is that they are not causal. They are descriptive. They describe what will predict a good relationship. They don't cause a good relationship. So many therapists saw that finding and they said, well, all we have to do is make people more positive. You know, and if they just have more positive interactions, then they've got their ratio up. Hot dog, and they're going to be happy. Well, they weren't happy. You know, it's because and I'm just dealing with the relationships rather than all the others. But the, you know, what the cause of a good relationship is, this is my secret for today, the cause of a good relationship is a relationship in which you can form, maintain, grow, and repair when damaged, a strong emotional bond. If you have those characteristics, it turns out your ratio will be 5-1 or greater. So does 5-1 or 10-1, it doesn't really matter. In fact, there are all kinds of fine tuning, if you will, on this, such as it really matters the sequence at which things occur. So you can imagine a couple that's a very fragile couple. You know, they are really troubled. And so they walk around on eggshells and they have positive, 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 and they have 100 positive, you know, interactions. But as soon as one of them says something negative, then it goes bing, 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 you know, negatives back and forth, and they end up with 20 negatives. That couple has a 5-1 ratio, not a good prognosis because of the fine tuning that is going on here, how you put the 5-1 together.
Thank you very much, Dr. Woodman.